welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I'm hosting today, Becky Friedman, and our call-in number is 844-SKEPTIC. We accept voicemail messages at any time. We'd love to have some voicemail messages, but in lieu of having some voicemails of folks asking an atheist, today in the studio with me, I've got Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
And Paul.
Hello.
So I'm so glad that both of you guys are here with me today in the studio, because there was something that came up with regards to religion. And we as atheists tend to look for, you know, making sure that, you know, all creeds and people of all different religious faiths and of no religious affiliations, you know, are treated equally by our government, and particularly by the military. Now, Paul, you've got some experience in the military.
Just a little bit.
just a 20-year career kind of thing.
20 years.
Yeah. Both of you have some experience with wearing facial hair.
This is true.
So my question here comes as to why you as atheists have decided to wear facial hair. Does your beard and mustache and goatee, does that have anything to do with your atheism?
No, not in particular. I'm trying to think of a connection.
I was trying to think of something good to say.
Yeah.
But no, nothing to do with a religious angle.
I can't commit to a deity, and I can't commit to shaving. So
it's a little bit different from, say, someone of the Sikh religion or someone from Norse heathen paganism. An undated military memo authorizing a follower of Norse pagan heathenism to maintain a beard recently has come to light. The army has permitted beards for religious individuals since last year, resolving a longstanding request and lawsuit from Sikh service members. But unlike Sikhism, in which beards are generally seen as a requirement for faithful adherence, heathen followers consider beards to be merely preferable as opposed to mandatory. The memo was issued by Missouri's Fort Wood Military Police to a soldier whose name had been redacted, stating that the soldier's request to wear a beard was granted in observance of his heathen Norse pagan faith, so long as he observed army uniform and grooming standards for soldiers with approved religious accommodation. This strikes me as something kind of funny, because, you know, as you're saying, OK, well, this is something that's very dear and essential to an army member who is of a particular faith where beards are required. What is the difference between just merely preferring a beard as part of your religion or requiring a beard as part of your religion or just preferring a beard because you prefer to wear a beard? You can't commit to a deity and you can't commit to shaving.
It definitely introduces some kind of a gray area where, you know, it's not a requirement, but it's a preference. And to what degree is it a preference? How common is it in that religion? Would he be outcast if he were to shave? Like, it raises a bunch of questions that I think might be factors in whether or not it should be accommodated, I guess.
And speaking of those gray areas, someone with a little bit more experience and a little bit more gray in his beard, are there any other, you know, circumstances in which beards could be permitted for someone serving in the armed forces?
No, I think this was a real well played out thing by the Sikh servicemen, because I've seen this same thing played out, challenged for facial hair. Since I went in the service in 1966, and it would shot down all the time. I'm surprised it passed this time.
Well, between 2015 or 2014 and 1966, there's a lot of fighting that's been required or been, you know, been going on in order to get this.
Haircut and beard regulations are always key.
There's also medical factors that might go into and play a role in whether you can retain or must shave a beard. And, you know, post-military service, your experience is largely within healthcare. So, Paul, what plays out that would allow someone to have a beard that isn't religiously based?
When shaving, if you're getting bumps on your face, you can get a thing that says you don't need to shave a profile.
Do you think that that's a...
But it's always been primarily black soldiers have been authorized this. And, of course, that's where the problem comes in is a medical problem is covered under that, but I've never heard of a
so there's religious there's the potential for a legitimate medical issue that
yes,
would
there is
that would,
very definite that would very definite
that would legitimize. Cause someone to want to keep their beard and
yes.
to not shave because shaving itself is what presents a medical issue for somebody.
And the bumps, as far as I understand, or I'm led to understand, it's not just the like, oh, it's kind of inconvenient. That's actually kind of a condition that's recurrent, can cause infections, can cause some scarring.
And painful.
Okay. So obviously someone would be distracted if, you know, if they had something that was required as part of their uniform that would cause physical pain, things like that. I mean, because it's not like being in boot camp is painful. In any respect, right? I mean, is this at what point does this become an intolerable, you know, experience? And my question here is: to what degree does a medical issue warrant dispensation, and a religious issue also warrant dispensation? And I think that once they decided for Sikh service members to do this, it kind of by default, you know, the lawsuit was brought by Sikh men, but. It by default opened it up to anyone with any claims to religious dispensation and accommodation. So the question here is, you know, to what degree is our American military accommodating people of a religious background versus preferencing and privileging them over, say, service members who don't abide by a particular religion? And that's kind of an interesting, you know, question. And then I think, well, why do we need to have these regulations anyway on not having a beard? I mean, you know, maybe you guys would be, you know, perfectly fit soldiers in spite of your beards and in spite of your atheism. But what's I mean, what's the whole advantage of having everybody all clean shaven anyway?
That's my question, too. Is there any reason that the military would prefer men to be clean shaven? Is there any tactical or organizational advantage to that?
And I would say the fitting of a gas mask.
Oh, okay.
Would be about the only thing that I could figure. If you have a lot of facial hair, your mask is not going to seal, so it would allow that. The other thing is if you're in a combat situation, you don't want somebody grabbing you by the beard.
Sure.
Is that also sort of the you know, you're sporting right now a big long ponytail,
mm-hmm.
You know, I'm imagine...
also not starting any fights.
so you steer clear of that. But as soon as steer you were clear. To enter into a combat situation, you wouldn't want anyone grabbing hold of that.
Yeah, it's a liability at
okay.
that point.
You know, as someone who has not been part of military culture, it's sort of the uniform requirements, the hair requirements, and things like that. Have always seemed to me to be to reek more of we need everyone to be alike. We need everyone to fall in line. We need no individuality because individuality threatens our unity as a fighting force. And we've had over the years different regulations on tattoos, on piercings, on, you know, can you have short braids? Can you have twists in your hair if you have black hair? And a lot of those have really seemed like you're punishing or putting down not accommodating in some way a lot of physical and cultural things, yet we find that religious accommodations are perfectly fine to accommodate. And that's one of those areas where I think, you know, why does religion get a pass at this, whereas a black service member who wants to keep their hair in braids close fitting to the scalp that are not easily grabbed in a combat situation by an enemy don't seem to pose a safety risk? Why are those not accommodated? Why does religion get the pass of saying, oh, this is just something I like because it's a part of my religious tradition? A religious tradition that I might add is fairly new and constantly being reinvented. I mean, we as atheists tend to sometimes embrace the word heathen because we get called that by people. But they're also with this Norse pagan, you know, resurgence, this sort of neo-pagan. That's a modern, you know, practice that's being constantly refined, reinvented.
Can I present a theory? So I'm not sure I'm advocating for this, but maybe hypothetically, it seems to me that a large part of the, you know, the uniform, the dress code in the army or in the military is to kind of to stamp out a little bit of the individuality, to create a uniform cohesiveness among the group, and to kind of bind people together, to kind of keep them under your thumb a little bit. And in the case of someone with I want to say a mere personal preference for a certain hairstyle or facial hair, that's an expression of their individuality. Whereas somebody who's adhering to a religious practice for their for that expression, that's an expression of unity within that religion, perhaps.
It would be an expression of unity within your religion, but would that unity not threaten your participation in, quote, the religion of your team, in the unity of your squadron or your platoon or your group, your military group?
Well, maybe not. I mean, maybe just as one's sexual orientation or gender doesn't necessarily separate them from the group, and those groups are being incorporated into the religion, so might one's religious expression not necessarily distinguish oneself from the group in a negative way, and that would encompass their expression of their religion in their physical appearance.
I really like that. I think you might have slipped and said religion instead at one point, instead of the military group or the military unit, because I think that there are similarities. There's similarities between the top down directives from a lot of religions and the top down hierarchical structures that are found sometimes in military. But Paul, I think that you might be able to speak to that a little bit more. What similarities between, you know, a religious hierarchy and sort of the being a participant in a military unit, you know? What kinds of things are there that you might see as similar?
I see a lot of similarities. To label them, I'm not. There's a lot of similarity in your hierarchy, because you have the authority figures that are setting all the standards, and you're supposed to follow. So there's a lot of similarity, and when you start combining the two, you can.
It's not just that there's an authority figure, though. It's about the infallibility of that authority figure, to
exactly.
agree, isn't it?
Exactly.
So you're not supposed to question your orders. You're not supposed to question your religious doctrine.
I'm also seeing, you know, I can't help but notice, Paul, you threw off the yoke of religion. You also threw off the yoke of military participation in a very visible and strident way. I mean, your history after your experience in the war, you've talked about that on this show before. You weren't all, you know, coming back from Vietnam saying, wahoo, let's go fight another war. Let's continue. You became very active in anti-war activities.
Very definitely did.
And in you're not shy now about your opinion of young people in the military are continuing to have such a robust military service as part of our American tradition. Are you not?
My grandson just went in the Navy.
Ooh, and that might be...
Just finished boot camp.
So how do you then you feel about that?
I have a lot of mixed feelings. I understand the things that make him want to go into the service. I've experienced them, so I can't say, you don't do that. On the other hand, I have also had a lot of good experience in the military. It's such a double-edged sword. The thing is the timing and the things that are going on right now. I would have that's where my trepidation comes in, and him going in.
I think one of the things it also points to or reflects is that you have some good things that you experienced in the military and things that you treasure. And those of us that maybe grew up within a religion, we have things that we were fond of. We have parts of the religion that we really enjoy. And just because we leave the religion doesn't necessarily mean that we stop participating in those things that were excellent. And it doesn't mean necessarily that we say those things are off limits now that I'm no longer part of a religion. So those things that were good that you treasure, the camaraderie between individuals, the the international focus, if you're deployed in different areas, those are not necessarily things that you have to throw away just because you leave either the military or a particular religion. Speaking of leaving a particular religion, I'd like to bring us to the story of one young man who bravely threw off the yoke. I don't know if he's brave or not, but this is the story of a boy who claimed to have died and come back from heaven after a car crash. He is suing Christian book publisher Tyndale to stop using his likeness and story. Alex Malarkey was left paraplegic after a 2004 car accident in which his father, Kevin, was driving. After being in a coma for 2 months, Alex awoke claiming to have toured heaven and met with Jesus and the devil during that time. Alex's story, The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven, was co-penned by his father and publisher Tyndale in 2010. It was taken off shelves in 2015 when Alex retracted the story, saying he made it up for attention. The current suit claims that Tyndale has profited millions of dollars off of Alex's likeness and alleged autobiographical story while paying him nothing. So, Alex is now a 20-year-old young man. He is still a paraplegic. It's been, you know, several years since he said this. I recant this story.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that caught my attention here was he claimed to tour heaven and meet Jesus and the devil. The devil in heaven? Oh my goodness! You think that, you know, this Christian book publisher might have...
This thing is broken wide open.
Yes. That might have, you know, caused a little bit of skepticism there. But are you guys familiar with these stories of, you know, young people or anyone that goes through a traumatic experience and, you know, dies and then goes to heaven?
Only in passing. I have never paid them a whole lot of credence, so I don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about them.
Okay, all right. You didn't purchase Alex Malarkey's book?
No. I think my thoughts on the book were summed up in the author's last name, I think.
Yep.
So, in working in healthcare and especially in emergency response, you must have experience in folks that have had near-death experiences and then lived afterwards, or who were maybe clinically dead and then revived through medical means. Any of them say that they meet Jesus?
I have not had anyone say they've met Jesus, but I have had people that say they have had out-of-body experiences.
And how do you respond to that? Or are you just trying to keep their blood pressure up?
You just got to go with it. I mean, you're not going to argue with these people. They're whatever was real to them. And so you just got to say, okay.
Speaking of real, this is not actually the same kid that was featured in another book and that got made into a movie called Heaven Is For Real. That was a different child that apparently, saw this.
Was that Tony Baloney?
That was actually, that was the story of Colton Burpo when he was a pastor's kid and he was 3 years old. He apparently went in for surgery. Wasn't clinically dead during the surgery, but apparently met Jesus, who rode on a rainbow horse, and met Mary and all these kinds of things. Supposedly spoke of family members that were long deceased and things like that. And the parents became really convinced that this actually happened. This was proof of their conception of heaven. Not like, you know, being the kid of a pastor and a toddler with a wild imagination, highly active imagination.
I mean, how often do we consider 3-year-olds to be credible sources?
I don't know. I get told by toddlers that, you know, Plato is food.
Yeah.
I think that we should reconsider this. So, yeah. So I think that what's really the message here is, Paul, you said, you know, their experience is real to them. But just because that experience is real to them and has been highly detailed or even articulated within a book doesn't mean we got to make money off of it on the back of the kid who said it. And it doesn't mean that we have to take it as a given, because someone who had a near-death experience in the middle of India, probably not going to be meeting Jesus on a rainbow horse, probably going to be, I don't know, face-to-face with Ganesha or a different particular deity that you might be exposed to. Funny how the evangelical pastor's kid didn't see Ganesha, you know, in his near-death experience. Just, you know, little thing to think about there to see, you know, maybe there's something up with that.
Might be where he grew up.
Yeah. Might have something to do with that. This is Ask an Atheist. You can email us at questions@atheist.radio. Find us at our website there. and leave us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. We'll be back after the break. Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you. And welcome back to Ask an Atheist, where we're in the studio with me, Becky Friedman, and Mike Warbington and Paul Mops.
Hello.
And, you know, there's some stuff that sometimes we talk about that's, you know, political. And I think we're about ready for it because, you know, this speaks directly to some things that maybe atheists might not be too fond of and maybe some, you know, people of religious faith might not be too fond of. And that is having to do with the House chaplain. Do you guys know that there's a chaplain that's paid by Congress, that's paid by the United States government?
No, I didn't actually know that. I wasn't shocked or surprised either, but it wasn't something that I knew.
So this actually is a little bit of drama here. There's some little things that have to do with Paul Ryan, that have to do with some politics here, have to do with some minority religions things here, and even taxation. So 2 weeks after House Speaker Paul Ryan forced the resignation of Congressional Chaplain Father Patrick Conroy, the Roman Catholic priest has been told that he actually may continue his position. Conroy had delivered a prayer that asserted that the nation's institutions and structures allow some to achieve great success while others continue to struggle. The prayer also called for representatives' efforts to guarantee that there are not winners and losers under new tax laws, but benefits balanced and shared by all Americans. The chaplain told the New York Times that he recalled Speaker Ryan telling him, "Padre, you just gotta stay out of politics." Ryan asserted that he'd lost confidence in the quality of Conroy's pastoral care, and that was the reason for his dismissal. But after harsh backlash, Ryan has allowed the chaplain to rescind his resignation from his 172,500 a year job. I stumbled over that because I just can't believe that this is not like a stipended, you know, position of saying, "Oh, we'll pay for your travel accommodations to and from D.C." No, he gets more than twice my salary as a public school teacher, far more than twice my salary as a public school teacher in order to pray in government.
Yeah, there's so much about this issue that frustrates me. Like, first off, as we were kind of wondering why there was a chaplain in a public position like this in the first place, why is there a chaplain being paid by Congress? That's the existence of that position is in question. So, first and foremost,
the answer there is history. Mm-hmm. Paul, you were going to say something?
Yeah, it's amazing because, leastways when I was in the military, the military chaplains were supposedly paid by the church to the government their salary.
So if you were a Catholic priest?
You would be paid by the whatever diocese you worked out of was paying the government your salary.
Okay,
and your government was paying the salary according to your rank.
So whatever denomination you were in,
whatever denomination you were drawing, basically from that church was paying your salary, not the government, supposedly.
Maybe that's the big fight over humanist chaplaincies. I don't know, but I think American Humanist Association or the Humanist Society would be more than willing to pay for the humanist chaplain in the military. That's a fight that is not over at all. And
we've been periodically
revisiting that. And I think that there's definitely some things coming up that we'll be talking about as humanists and non-religious people try and fight for representation and care in the military. But hey, you know what? I mean, why do we need a chaplain at the congressional level? And you said, you know, why do we even have that? This actually, you know, I was doing a little bit of reading on this because it seems like this is a violation of separation of church and state. How do we even have this?
I mean, it seems like an endorsement of religion to have a member of a particular religion be the chaplain.
Well, yeah, and in this case, the chaplain is Father Pat Conroy. He's a Catholic priest. If there was, you know, something, if there was anything that said, hey, we are establishing a national religion, it's having national representatives, you know, be led by the leadership, by the authority of someone from a specific religion, mm-hmm. you know, let alone religion versus non-religion in general. But actually, so the chaplaincy was really instituted in the late 1700s at the suggestion of none other than Ben Franklin. So we as atheists and humanists really like to point to some of our patriotic founders as folks who were deists or non-theists. I mean, we love to talk about Jefferson, how he redacted a whole bunch of God stuff from the Bible and just left what he thought was the good stuff. You know, Thomas Paine making a lot of, you know, atheistic writings. Well, Ben Franklin was kind of not really on board with that, and he actually really appreciated, you know, the religious individuals and clergy leadership and things like that. So he made this discussion to say, hey, you know what, we're fighting over a whole bunch of stuff. Why don't we ask for some outside help to bless us and guide us and get some heavenly assistance in the things that we're disagreeing on? And this is the late 1700s. And so Ben Franklin is a little bit past his, you know, writing time. He's past his, you know, courageous inventing time. he's kind of sitting back in his old age.
This is Ben
age.
Franklin in his old age time, yeah.
Right. So they did relent. And actually, Madison, I found that he reflected in a memo from 1820, so far after this time, on reflecting on that time, that he actually believed that having a house chaplain was unconstitutional on its face. But he was kind of outruled, or he relented at the time. But he actually wrote, the establishment of the chaplainship to Congress is a palpable violation of equal rights as well as of constitutional principles. The tenets of the chaplains elected shut the door of worship against the members whose creeds and consciences forbid a participation in that of the majority. So it's really fascinating to hear that. And later on in that memo, he actually goes in defense. What about all the elected Catholic people? What are they going to do? Because at the time, their chaplain was not Catholic. But I like that he specifically talks about creeds and consciences, because it was very much a thing for our founders. You know, I mean, Madison was well versed with people who were deists and Quakers and didn't belong to majority religions, which was sort of Methodist, Baptist, the Protestant religions of, mm-hmm. of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, why do we have this now? I mean, if it was established then, why do we have it now? Yeah, history. Seems kind of junky, right? Like in the 80s.
Well, I mean, it seems like it's not merely a historical artifact, though. There's a modern movement to have religious invocations at the beginning of, you know, council meetings and the movement to put "In God We Trust" onto police cars, and so there's an active movement to and in schools, and to post the Ten Commandments at public buildings. Like there's an active movement to inject religion into the public sphere.
And what are they emboldened by but history? That's what they're emboldened by. And this really puts the lie to face here, because the fact that the founders did this with the chaplaincy way back in the late 1700s has been given credence in court rulings. So like even in 2005, SCOTUS upheld that a Texas Ten Commandments monument was okay because, and this is actually argued by Breyer, by Justice Stephen Breyer, no one had complained about it in 40 years. So it's tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But at the, you know, around the same time, a Kentucky Ten Commandments monument was struck down as unconstitutional because it was kind of new. So we're in this balance between, you know, is it ceremonial deism? Is it just a part of the traditions of our country? Or is this a new thing? And you have people that are emboldened by history saying, hey, the motto of "In God We Trust" has been around since 54. So therefore, it's not inherently religious. And I think that this really points to, anytime we have something new that is religious, there really is a motivation. It's incumbent upon us to call it out, because otherwise we risk some Supreme Court justice 40 years from now saying no one's complained about it in 40 years, so mm-hmm. it must be fine, further than emboldening other people to inject all of their religion all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So, the congressional chaplain, right? And even if we just went by tradition,
mm-hmm.
the congressional chaplain was brought up by Ben Franklin to try and get people to agree. Let's call on heavenly assistance to try and get us to calm down a little bit, simmer down a little bit, right? What does this current Pat Conroy do? He said, hey, guys, you're debating tax reform, Republican-led tax reform. Oh, by the way, boss, you really should try and make things a little bit more equal, because, you know, my religious faith tells me that we got to, you know, undo a lot of these structures here so that we don't have haves and have nots.
He didn't even really go that far. I mean, what he actually said is to say that there shouldn't be winners and losers. So
right.
he wasn't even calling out anything specific about the law that was under question, just more of a general guidance that let's make sure that whatever laws we pass, they're beneficial to everybody and not, you know, detrimental to some.
But do you really call that out in your prayer specifically so that, you know, when it's wholly Republican led, he said, during these new tax laws, who are they put forth by, you know, if not Paul Ryan and his coalition of Republicans?
But I mean, if you're going to have a chaplain there and he's supposed to give guidance, either on a real, what else is he supposed to say? I mean,
well, I'm sure Paul Ryan would just rather him say something nice like God bless us all and we love God, right?
Sounds right.
Right, but if you're hiring presumably a man of principle to a position of, you know, of spiritual leadership, which, you know, as we just discussed, I'm not really on board with, but let's say you do, don't you have to then respect his input on the proceedings?
Well, he does now, because he has to rescind the firing. He said, oh, sorry, just kidding. I'm cool with you being in this position right now. So I think that Paul Ryan got a face full of that from religious individuals, from, you know, certainly Democrats who saw this as you know, trying to silence people that were critical of the Republican tax plan, but through a religious lens and a religious context, which is kind of a really neat angle that we don't often explore or see.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that, you know, we rightly said, you know, you rightly said, Mike, that this is not something we're kind of on board with in general. And one of the really neat things to come out of this whole, you know, brouhaha is that you have a lot more individuals that are being vocal about just that point. So to that end, you had the Washington Post, you had the Chicago Sun-Times, you had the New Jersey Herald, the Chicago Tribune, and a whole bunch of newspapers within the Tribune News Service Network that all published op-eds advocating for the end of congressional chaplains.
I do think it's interesting that this situation being brought to light, it kind of brings that practice of having the chaplain to the public discussion, and we have to start questioning why we continue this practice.
If we're really pluralistic, if we really want to uphold separation of church and state, what do we do? Why are we doing this? And, you know, there's sort of also the discussion of Catholic dominance within, you know, politics. It's a minority religion within, you know, within our country, but a lot of elected officials, particularly from northern states, happen to be Catholic, including, I think, Paul Ryan himself. But say, hey, you know what? We're really being influenced a lot more by other sorts of, you know, religious factions, and, you know, pushes by evangelicals and whatnot, which makes up a large portion of the Republican base. But we're also having now, at this point, finally, some influence in politics and some attention in politics and some footing in politics as humanists, as atheists, as freethinkers. And this brings us to something that's really cool, that's really good. A group of four U.S. congressional representatives have formed a Free Thought Caucus. So Jared Huffman of California and Jamie Raskin of Maryland will co-chair the new caucus, whose mission includes protecting secular government by upholding the separation of church and state, opposing discrimination against atheists, agnostics, humanists, seekers, and religious and non-religious persons, and promoting sound public policy based on reason, science, and moral values. The other members are Jerry McNerney of California and Dan Kildee of Michigan. When you guys heard this, what did you think of it?
Originally, I thought it was pretty cool.
Oh, originally? Have you changed on that?
Well, no.
Okay.
Not really.
All right.
If that was your first impression. Yeah, that was my impression too. I think it's good to have. I mean, I'm a little disappointed that it's only four people, but you have to start somewhere, I suppose.
Exactly.
I would like to see more people join the caucus. But I do think it's cool that there's something with the name Free Thought on it. You know, that position is being given a voice, even if it's a, you know, a minority or a small voice.
I think that it's really neat when you look at, you know, the prayer caucus or, you know, different caucuses, different, you know, groups within congressional representatives that are so big, that have so much footing with other organizations. You know, you have a caucus of individuals that really push for the faith-based initiatives at the federal level. And this provides me hope with, hey, you know what? If we have these faith-based initiatives and it's part of law and it's entrenched in public policy, maybe we can't get rid of it, but maybe we can say, hey, if you're having faith-based initiatives, how are you making sure that these are non-discriminatory? Or how are you making sure that through faith-based and community initiatives, the community part isn't being erased? And if there's someone from a humanist background that has a humanist community, how can they also get a piece of that pie in order to serve our fellow residents and Americans and citizens here?
Mm-hmm.
One thing that struck out to me was only one of these guys counts himself as someone who doesn't really believe in God, and that's Jared Huffman.
That was my question: was along the lines of how do these guys identify? Are they clearly there's some sort of freethinker label that they identify with? But does that mean atheist? Does that mean humanist? How are there any avowed atheists in this group?
There's no atheists in Congress. Oh, no, sorry, nah. I lied. Nah. There's no one willing to call themselves an atheist in Congress. And there's nine of them that refuse to put a religious label on themselves, because when you fill out your thing, you know, you can say, oh, I'm Roman Catholic, I'm Baptist, I'm Jewish, you know, whatever. So Jamie Raskin does say Jewish, and he did really step back from the suggestion that he was atheistic in any sense of the term by saying, nope, 100% Jewish, very proud of my Jewish heritage. And we've talked about Jamie Raskin in the past because he sponsored a few bills or sponsored a few resolutions to have things like Free Thought Day or Darwin Day, things like that. Jared Huffman also has said, hey, you know what? The label that applies to me best is humanist. But elected officials are still very, very reticent to use that A word, mm-hmm. right? To use that atheist word. And you'll notice that the Free Thought Caucus has no mention of the word, you know, it's not an atheist caucus. It's not mm-hmm. a caucus of atheist individuals. They do say we want to oppose discrimination against atheists, agnostics, humanist seekers, religious and non-religious persons. I really like that it's called out there specifically
mm-hmm.
saying, hey, we don't want to discriminate against atheists. We want to make sure that the work of government does not discriminate against atheists. And I think that's a win. That's an important
wind.
Absolutely.
To even be mentioned.
I think it's all too often that even the mere mention of an atheist is shunned and treated as something offensive, that atheists even exist is something offensive.
Right. A neat thing here, though, is Jerry McNerney and Dan Kildee, both of those guys are Roman Catholic on their little, you know, questionnaire thing. There's kind of a neat thing of this coinciding with the firing and rehiring of the Catholic chaplain. And just as Madison had written, right, about 200 years ago, saying, you know, we want to make sure that you don't privilege the majority and interfere with the right of the minority to affiliate and worship as they choose. You know, there's a real investment here of someone from a minority religion saying, you know what, I want to be part of the Free Thought Caucus that also protects, you know, these non-religious people, because if we're protecting non-religious people, we're also protecting Catholics, we're also protecting Sikhs, we're also protecting, you know, Jewish folks, because religious pluralism you know, requires that separation of church and state, requires that you watch out for the rights of others to worship or non-worship as they see fit. So I think it's pretty cool. My only disappointment is that none of these guys will adopt that A word, right? Still waiting, wondering when we're going to have the actual avowed atheist. Because we did have one for a little while, Pete Stark in California. Lost his primary to another Democrat, and you know has been out of Congress for a while.
And I think that's the reason, right there, is that it's probably still a little bit of political poison. There's even people
a little bit.
Well,
I looked up, and you know, most of these guys. So let's see, we've got Huffman, we've got McNerney, we've got Kildee, and we've got Jamie Raskin. All of these are listed as safe Democrats. No challenge to losing their seat. And so, yeah, it might be political poison, but not poisonous enough to boot you from something that's safe from challenge, mm-hmm. you know, safe from opposition in an election. And that's something that I think, even as we celebrate that we actually got named, right? We've got a recognition there,
yeah.
That, there's still a lot of work to be done in politics in that respect. So I don't know if you guys think, you know, maybe within 2 years, maybe within 6 years, maybe within 5 years, when are we going to have that actual atheist in Congress or in the Senate or on the Supreme Court bench or in the White House? Hello and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Today it's me, Becky Friedman, with Mike and Paul in the studio.
Hi there.
And I'm just going to get into this one because, well, it was brought to our attention from listener Dean from France. Thank you. We do have listeners all worldwide because you can find us at atheist.radio in addition to locally here in Tacoma where we produce our weekly show. And this is about more politics and maybe a little bit more on the skepticism side of things. That's important many times to atheists. Trump's White House announced that he will be appointing a series of sports heroes and celebrities to the Presidential Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition. Among them are celebrity Dr. Mehmet Oz, former TV actor and bodybuilder Lou Ferrigno, and football coach Bill Belichick. The council is a division of the Health and Human Services Department and aims to, quote, empower all Americans to adopt healthy lifestyles that include regular physical activity and good nutrition. Dr. Oz, whose line of weight loss products have been heavily promoted through Oprah's media venues and his own show, was called before Congress, actually 4 years ago, to answer inquiries of fraudulent, unscientific claims. Oz was also the target of an open letter by preeminent doctors who accused him of manifesting an egregious lack of integrity and called for his removal from the faculty at New York's Columbia University. One other member includes SlimFast CEO Chris Tesi. Guys, we're going to be led by Dr. Oz. Are you guys ready by this?
My first reaction to this is, are they appointing Dr. Oz to a cabinet position? Is he some kind of, like, is he the leader of President Trump's, you know, is he the next guy up who's going to give President Trump a resounding physical report? What's next here? Are we going to have TV judges on the Supreme Court or Judge Judy appointed to a federal position?
Like, you got it. Hold back. Your bile is justified in some senses. Your panic, I believe, is not. As much as Dr. Oz, who really has his, you know, miracle drugs and whatnot, this is this council. Yeah, it's part of Health and Human Services. It's the Presidential Council on PR that tells school kids that you should do after school sports. It's the council that says, let's do a government sponsored PSA that talks about walking for 20 minutes a day can help you reduce your risk of diabetes, that kind of stuff. So we can breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief.
Lazier.
breathe a little easier. Yep. I mean, Dr. Oz would probably say that it's attributable to his miracle weight loss cures, of course. But if we want to look at criticizing the Trump administration for installing people in positions of power that promote or abide by really unscientific claims that really might be financially motivated, you know, go digging into Scott Pruitt, right? I mean, EPA, if these things continue to get reversed, we're looking at worse environmental disasters than we've seen and imagined. But Dr. Oz on this presidential, you know, fitness, nutrition thing. You know, I imagine that I don't actually know when this started. It was probably when we were in about elementary school, maybe in the 70s. So Paul, you might have missed this beautiful opportunity.
Darn.
But in public schools, you run the 50-yard dash. You try and do as many sit-ups as possible. You do so many pull-ups. You do this like standing broad jump. And depending on how well you do, you might get a certificate at the end of the year fifth grade assembly signed by none other than, well, in my case, Arnold Schwarzenegger and George Herbert Walker Bush, saying, "Good job, Rebecca. You made some meritorious achievement on things." Don't worry, I only got it during fourth grade. You probably got it all, you know, grade levels.
I didn't get it once. I took one look at how many times I needed to jump rope, and I said, "No, thank you. That's not for me."
Oh, the rope jumping one. I don't know that we had a rope jumping physical fitness. I was terrified of the rope climbing one. And I think that was eliminated somewhere in mid-elementary school for me. You know, you always see that climb to the top and ring the bell of the rope.
It's always in the coming of age movies of that are set in high schools in the 80s.
Yeah, some John Hughes movies, right, and things like that. Oh, dear.
Because that was true in the 60s.
Did you climb to the top of your rope?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But you didn't have the benefit of having a TV actor bodybuilder sign a certificate saying, "Good job, Paul."
This is true. I missed it.
So while I had Arnold Schwarzenegger, Terminator, be able to sign mine, children now can have the privilege of having a 1970s Hulk bodybuilder Lou Ferrigno sign. Not any of many Hulks that have since.
Not exactly the most timely Hulk.
Do you think that Trump is just, "Oh, kids like comic books. Comic book movies are doing well. Let's have a comic person actor." Do you think that was the best he could get?
I'd be surprised if he could find a whole lot of people in Hollywood that to sign on for anything he was doing these days.
I would agree with that.
I mean, Trump is the celebrity president, right? And so, you know, this isn't anything that's surprising to me. I do kind of worry a little bit about that Judge Judy thing, because I think that is within the purview of what might be possible.
Could be. Right. I mean,
but you know, I mean, there's some folks on the council that, you know, promote physical fitness. There's a woman from Wyoming who's an advocate for outdoorsmanship and outdoor hunting who uses a wheelchair. So looking at people of all different abilities, maintaining health and physical fitness and participation in the outdoors. You know, you have some lawyers and some marketers, because it's basically a marketing thing. It's a division saying this is what you should do. The SlimFast CEO, though, I mean, that's another one that isn't getting a lot of attention in the skeptic community. That's one that worries me, because we've had a lot of studies that show supplements for the population on whole, not really that beneficial. Sometimes, you know, not regulated well. You know, a lot of those things say claims, you know, unverified by the FDA. And you've got someone with a financial interest in pushing supplements and meal replacements, you know, on people. So are we going to start seeing that the best way to be healthy is, you know, we're moved on from 1980s ketchup is a vegetable in school lunches to your SlimFast is your meal replacement?
The Presidential Council on Fitness, sponsored by SlimFast, and thereby adding legitimacy to a product that's not, you know, science-based and not health-based.
I think that's
worrisome.
That's something that someone who is based in science, based in reason, and using critical thinking skills to look at the motivations of these individuals, that's something that warrants attention.
Mm. Yes, it does.
I do got to say, I was kind of excited. I saw Mariana Rivera is actually one of the co-chairs of the council, so baseball player. Johnny Damon, who was one of my favorite Red Sox players when he was playing before he was a turncoat and went to the Yankees. And I think now he's in Florida at this point, but he's going to be an advisory member. And so we got some baseball players in there, you know, because being a professional baseball player is incredibly healthy. It's not like pitchers blow out their elbows at, you know, age 26 or, you know, getting hit in the head. And football coaches, for that matter, it's not, you know, like, you know, there's major studies that show that repetitive concussion leads to terrible brain outcomes. Right. You know, I mean, that's all real healthy stuff, right? Call me skeptical.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
So I don't know that we'll be advised too heavily by Mehmet Oz. We can only hope that this too shall pass.
Yeah, I'm just frustrated at the whatever degree of legitimacy that this provides to him.
That's it.
So, speaking of legitimacy, I want to shift a little bit to something that provides humanism a little bit of legitimacy. It's really cool. So, a man incarcerated in the North Carolina state prison system has succeeded in his efforts to get humanism recognized as a faith group. Kwame Teague originally listed his religious preference as Muslim because humanism had no recognition or allotted time for study and fellowship, as was the case for other religions. Teague petitioned the warden of Warren Correctional Facility in 2012 and sued for recognition in 2015 with the aid of the American Humanist Association, which has helped resolve similar disputes in other states. U.S. District Judge Terrence Boyle ruled that officials failed to justify treating humanism differently from those religions that are recognized in the state's prisons and ordered North Carolina to include humanism as an option for inmates' religious declaration. What do you guys make of this?
I think it's good. I like that. It gives non-believers or free thinkers or agnostics or even, you know, the dreaded atheists some opportunity to get together in a group setting and experience some of the privileges that these religious groups have in that setting.
Now, I think none of us are particularly intimately acquainted with the experience of, you know, incarceration, especially as an atheist or a humanist. What I look at when I see this is, you know, initially, why do we need religions at all in a prison system? And I initially think, well, just because somebody's incarcerated doesn't mean that all of their rights as residents or as Americans or as citizens have been taken away. You know, there's definitely restriction on your life and liberty because you've violated some kind of law, and our society and our justice system has deemed that warrant restriction of your rights. But religion really hasn't been a part of that kind of restriction. And I think that that's one of the nice things that the First Amendment with freedom of religion does allow for. But if you're going to then allow for, you know, non-restrictive practice of your religion, you want to allow for non-restrictive observance and celebration and study of all kinds of creeds, including the non-theistic ones. So I think it's really cool to be able to have that. And it helps me also recall that we've had periodic listener of our show and periodic writer, Rick, who works in a local prison in Washington State, who actually wrote in a few months ago to talk about how he became the designated, you know, staff sponsor of an atheist study group at this local prison. So in Washington State, those things exist. We've had show listeners that have been incarcerated in Oregon who were instrumental in getting the federal prison system to recognize humanism as a recognized designation and be given the privileges to have those kinds of study groups. I'm trying to think about what kinds of things would be for a study group or a book club that have to do with humanism. I mean, if you were to be in a very restricted environment, how would you exhibit or practice, so to speak, your atheism or your humanism?
Well, one thing that comes to mind is something that we do at Camp Quest Northwest, which is Socrates Cafe. So it's a discussion format where you sit around in a circle or in a group, and the leader of the discussion poses a question, and so everyone in the group gets a chance to take a turn and address the question and kind of think about something in a philosophical sense and to exchange ideas and think critically about why we believe what we believe and the nature of reality or whatever question it is that you want to pose. So I feel like that's a good format for discussion.
I think that's a really neat suggestion because it's something that all three of us have observed as being incredibly powerful for young people.
Exactly.
And young people, by virtue of our society and where we put them, have restricted rights and are, you know, have restricted confidence, right? They're little. They don't really know things. They don't have much power. They have limited decision-making power and things like that. And there have been people that have written about how, you know, ways in which the, you know, prison systems really infantilize inmates and residents of the you know, facilities. And if we look to something that gives power and individual dignity to the thoughts and the thinking abilities of children, that's kind of a really neat parallel that could be incorporated into a justice system or correctional facility environment. What do you think, Paul?
I think so. I know that in the prison system, you have your groups that meet. For the atheist group or the free thinker group, there's generally nothing. And so where everybody else has an out or a way of talking to one another, the free thinkers are pretty much left in there.
I think you bring up a really good point of talking to each other, creating that fellowship, creating that social integration in a place where things are very different from you know, general society on the outside of prison walls, and providing that reintegrative venue and vehicle for human connection could be really important and cool. I do want to give a shout out to the American Humanist Association, not only for helping this particular inmate, but for also highlighting and featuring what it's like for non-theistic people and humanists currently incarcerated within our prison system. So there's some really cool articles and pieces that are being written in Humanist Magazine. And I think it's something that really warrants some consideration and further exploration. But that is going to be looking at all the time that we've got today with Paul and Mike. Thank you for joining me on Ask an Atheist.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
We can be tweeted at Ask an Atheist WA. You can find us on Facebook and on all sorts of social media. Our website is atheist.radio. Voicemail is 844-SKEPTIC, and you can email us questions that we'll respond to. You can email us anytime at questions@atheist.radio. Thanks for joining us this week. See you guys next.